Found here on Your Voice of Football, FNR, Football Nation Radio. I'm Josh Parrish, and each week myself and Nick DiBarno will debate the 20 hottest topics in Australian and European football in just the 1 hour, no holds barred. Nick, welcome.
Good afternoon, Josh. It's been a long time coming, but finally we're here, and this is going to be absolutely massive.
Yes, the storm has been coming for quite some time, but without further ado, let's get into it, starting with the SCG controversy, Nick. Should Sydney FC use the new Bankwest Stadium for their finals matches? Given that Cogra and Leichhardt don't have the capacity and Sydney doesn't have the pitch.
I think it has to end. It's got to end. You can't be playing games at the SCG full stop, but at Bankwest Stadium, it's a big move, considering that it is the home of the Western Sydney Wanderers and it might ruffle a few feathers.
Don't come down on one side of the fence or the other. Come on.
Look,
mate.
I think if they're going to play finals, it's not going to be there. They've got to play at Jubilee or they've got to play in Leichhardt. Not at Bankwest Stadium.
Let me ask you this question. Who owns Bankwest Stadium?
Good question.
It was bought and paid for by the New South Wales government. So in Western Sydney Wanderers and John Satsimas can come out and say all they like that it's their home ground and it will be next season. But really, they didn't pay for it. They don't have control over what matches take place. And surely with the A-League in absolute dire straits, you need to have the best possible finals venue to make the most revenue you can for the upcoming next season.
Yeah, look, it is interesting because obviously I think the only thing that I think of about this is that the Western Sydney Wanderers are going to be playing home games there next season. Obviously might be that bit of cultural divide. But in terms of actually the stadium itself, it'd be a fantastic way to kick it off. Would it not be? Mm. So I think that's the one logic I take out of it. But I think if you want to properly, if you don't want to be ruffling those feathers, I think that that's the best way. Look, I honestly think no. So I think that they've got Jubilee ready to go, but they shouldn't be playing at the SCG at all. That's just the way I think about it.
15,000 for a finals game. What if they host the grand final?
It will be at ANZ Stadium if they host the grand final.
And in their cavernous 80,000 seat arena.
It will be cavernous, but you're going to be allowed for the most fans to come in. I know that's going to be obviously the big talk has been, yeah, but you need to be having it at the small stadiums that fit everyone in. But no, at the end of the day, you want to get as many people in my opinion, because if it's in Sydney at ANZ Stadium, I reckon they could easily get about 60,000 people. I'm not saying that with any exaggeration. I reckon that you definitely could if it's marketed correctly. And if it's a big blue, why not? Because SFS, when they had it, 2016, I believe 2017 was the final there when they played the Melbourne Victory. The ticket demand was unbelievable, and we're very lucky for people actually to get seats for that game. And you think about it, you could probably definitely get more people in because Sydney obviously won't be hosting a grand final against Perth unless, barring the absolute miracle, happens in the past 3 weeks. But yeah, my stance on it all, just to sum it up, Bankwest Stadium, keep it out until next season.
I think FFA should make whatever decision they think is best for football and not think about whether they're hurting the Western Sydney Wanderers' feelings. They're already delaying the Macarthur Southwest Sydney bid coming into the A-League by an entire year just to satisfy the Western Sydney Wanderers' owners and their concerns about their dwindling fan base. So I don't think they have to keep making concessions to them. I think FFA have to say what is the best stadium for the game, whether that's Allianz, whether that's Jubilee, Cogra, if they even think they're going to get 30,000, then, maybe that's a consideration because Sydney's crowds haven't been impressive. I just don't think the Western Sydney Wanderers' little hurt feelings should really come into it.
Have you rated Jubilee and Leichhardt during this time? How have you seen the relocation this season or however long it will be until the new Sydney Stadium comes through? Because personally, I think Jubilee and Leichhardt, those two grounds in particular, have been major successes in terms of getting crowds in terms of atmosphere. How have you seen it?
It has been a huge success, and the SCG pitch was an absolute disgrace.
Yep.
And the fact that, they don't care about football whatsoever.
No, no.
They don't really even care about the AFL. Why should we even entertain the prospect of playing games there? Maybe they got a good commercial deal out of it, Sydney FC. I guess we'll never know. And obviously that contract wasn't worth the paper it was written on because they were able to shift the Perth game this weekend.
Well, funny story is that Sydney Swans are actually now starting to get up in arms about the ground yesterday. I was actually watching that game and it was absolutely terrible. There seems like there's still problems. Doesn't matter who's playing or whenever. There's obviously the talk about disrespecting A-League and disrespecting that, but there was 5 different sports played on there over the past week before that big blue, and it's continued, obviously, at 5 days. So maybe it comes more down to ground staff, because ANZ Stadium and Giants Stadium, as it's now called, formerly Spotless Stadium, has had its own problems for so long. It might just be, I don't know, what's going up there with Sydney's grounds with those ones, but it seems like they've never had problems with Jubilee or Leichhardt. They've come out looking absolutely fantastic.
There was a problem for the W League Grand Final. at Kogarah. Yeah, right, but for the men's matches, it's been absolutely good, pristine, and they did a lot of work on it.
I think we should now move on to the next topic, Josh.
We've got to adjust to the fast pace of this new format.
We've got to go. It is called the Lightning Round for a reason. And let's now move over to Europe because we're going to be rotating a little bit, not going all down the one path. Now, in the Champions League fixture in midweek, Tottenham played Manchester City, Tottenham with that 1-0 win. And Danny Rose gave away a penalty. It was a handball inside the box. Sergio Aguero went on to miss. But do you think it should have been paid?
I was screaming at my TV screen when the referee went over. Bjorn Kuipers, who is a referee I really like, but VAR is just the worst for handballs. I think VAR should be banned from a judging on handballs unless it's a Luis Suarez-esque volleyball on the line. That was a truly ridiculous call, and the fact that they play it in half, quarter, eighth speed, slow motion makes it look worse than it is. Yes, his hand was in the air, but you try sliding on going in for a block tackle with your hands by your sides. What's going to break your fall? You're just going to break your fall with your head? What's going to happen? That's a natural position. And the fact, the term natural position has been totally skewed to mean close to the body.
Yeah.
And there was an incident later in the match where Manchester City actually appealed for a handball. They didn't appeal for the one that was given. And Danny Rose had his hand tucked in across his chest, which is the most unnatural position you could possibly imagine.
Of course, yeah.
So
it's almost like you're wanting to get the handball paid against you for putting your hand up there.
Yeah, exactly. And yet that's never paid. I don't understand the VAR system in general, but for handballs, it just boggles my mind and it needs to be done away with.
Yeah, I have to agree with that one as well. I think that it was quite an interesting one because I've seen similar things being paid before when a player is sliding in, their arms up, and it gets paid quite a few times. I've actually seen it happen. There was a game on the weekend between Juventus and Milan where a similar thing happened with Alexandro, and it wasn't paid. So, but in that sort of position, what could Danny Rose have done? He actually went out and said that he admitted it, and I'm going to go by the stand saying it shouldn't have been a penalty, and I think Tottenham would have probably judged fairly, in my opinion, as well.
Well, I think we agree on that one. Let's move across to the next topic. And I think we'll go along the same lines. Will Manchester City come back next week? Tottenham have no Harry Kane. He's got an ankle ligament injury. They've got one goal deficit to turn around. Obviously, no away goal, which makes it a bit tough.
I'm going to say yes, and I think it's going to be a convincing win. I'm going out and saying this is not going to be pretty. I know Tottenham are up 1-0, but I think Man City are going to come out and clean them up. I just have this feeling when it comes to Man City, their form at home compared to where it's been, well, especially, it's maybe almost a Pep Guardiola thing. I saw a stat where he's barely won on the road in the Champions League in, I believe, the last few years at Barca, Bayern, and now at Manchester City. He's had this little thing about playing on the road and they seem to struggle. But when they're at home, it's almost a fortress. Like, we've seen times where Man City have played teams, it might not even be in the Champions League, might be in the league, the Carabao Cup, whatever else, and they obliterate teams at the Etihad. There is no reason why they can't do that. Harry Kane being out, you lose. I know Son's filled in quite well as a striker, but if they're going to start Fernando Llorente, I don't see goals coming from Fernando Llorente. No offence to him. Dele Alli's fractured his hand. That's another big player out.
Oh, he can play with a fractured hand. Just means he'll spend less time on Fortnite. Yeah. He'll be right.
Yeah. But like in that scenario where that hand, where he's hindered, because obviously as well, if the doctors think he's not going to play, then he's not going to play, right? Because it is a short turnaround. You're going to be losing a lot. I just think Man City are going to come out. If they get an early goal and they hit back early and then cut that deficit back to 1-1, there's no reason why they can't win 3 or 4-0 in this game.
I think Tottenham are going to do it, and I'll tell you why.
You think they're going to do it?
Yeah, I think they're going through. They've got a lead. Manchester City don't have an away goal. And you're perfectly right when you put out you highlight Manchester City's home record, but you're not taking into account that Pep Guardiola's brain snaps as soon as he gets into a Champions League knockout game. Ever since he left Barcelona, he doesn't seem to know what's happening. He tries to overcompensate.
We saw it last year in the game, in the tie with Liverpool.
He over-elaborates. How can you explain the substitutions in that game? Usually he's the proactive coach. He makes his substitutions before the hour mark. He changes the game, usually wins the game. Then against Tottenham at the new White Hart Lane, he brought on Kevin De Bruyne and Leroy Sané in the 89th minute, 88th minute.
Reminds me of someone down here.
Yeah. But I don't think he has the mettle in these games. He's got this anxiety about him. And also Tottenham have proved to be the team that Manchester City match up poorest against. Tottenham's physicality gives them problems. Their organisation, the way they press in midfield and interchange gives them issues. And Pep Guardiola, I think his teams are intimidated by the size and physicality. Tottenham going out to defend a lead, strike on the counter-attack, Harry Kane or not, I think they're going to score an away goal and I think they're going to go through just.
Well, we know a certain George Anae can be very glad hearing that, and I'm going to hear it all next Thursday if I cross his path and Tottenham are through to the semi-finals and Manchester City aren't. But I just have this feeling. City get going early and they're going to cause some problems. Let's bring it back to the A-League. We mentioned him very subtly just then, but Kevin Muscat's Melbourne Victory have had a very... How would you describe their season? Because the question we're posing is, have they underachieved with the squad that they have? Because a third place finish, like no matter what team you are, it's a home final. But when you look at the team on paper, the only thing that comes to mind for me is how are they not top? And considering you've got the likes of Honda, Toivonen and Barbarousis, Troisi, Bain, are those star players and they're third and they're struggling in Asia as well. Is this, if they don't win it, is this a big cross through their season?
I think with Victory, they're the clearest example that stars don't make a winning team necessarily. And you're only as good as your worst player sometimes. It's not like basketball. You can't rely on one or two, three stars.
Like you need like a LeBron James
exactly.
Just to bail you out.
In football, it's you know the weakest link. And Corey Brown, Storm Roo to a lesser extent, the lack of defensive cover in midfield, the Jorg Niedermeyer. I mean, he's been a nightmare.
At one point, it was nine different centre-back partnerships throughout the season.
The strength and conditioning has been all over the place, and that's something else we should address. But I think Victory are underachieving with the squad that they have. But it goes to show that in football, you have to have a rounded-out squad, and Tony Popovich has that, and that's why his team are top of the table and Victory are third.
Yeah, I think so. I think that left-back position in particular for me has been the Achilles heel. And if you want to, if you haven't seen much of it or you want a clear example, just go back and watch the game from Wednesday night against Guangzhou. It was Wednesday night, yep. And Anderson Talisca gave Corey Brown nightmares. I think that he's probably still thinking about Anderson Talisca when he's sleeping because that was just a clear gap in class between a guy that, you know, not long ago, I know that people forget this, but he was a player of the year at Brisbane Roar when they made the finals. Like he had there was a lot of big raps about Corey Brown and just this dip, it's just been so unceremonious and their defense was towed up. But in fairness though, it just seems like this Victory team have got one gear and that's just going forward. Brilliant when they go forward attacking wise, they have looked very good in when they've been on. You've spoken a lot about that game against Western Sydney at the start of the year. We've seen it when Honda's on, Toivonen's on, Barbarousis is on. They're almost unstoppable going forward. But defensively, they've been opened up time and time again. But we've seen these performances where they'll come out of nowhere and they'll beat Perth Glory on the road 2-1 in the most unconvincing of circumstances. But you go, look, you know what? If that happens in finals, does it really matter? Because let's be real, right? In the finals last year, now, Melbourne Victory, they beat Adelaide United in a very scrappy elimination final to kick it off. They beat Sydney FC. I thought that was a pretty good performance considering the circumstances, but very lucky considering what happened in the 90th minute and they could see it at their own goal, but to bounce back. And then to win the grand final with a goal which arguably shouldn't have stood. So it's this
definitively shouldn't have stood.
Yes. So you put all these different pieces of the puzzle together and you think, like, they've just seemed to get there just based on a bit of, I wouldn't say luck, but just getting, the thing about Victory is they just know how to get those wins when it matters in a way, like especially in the league. But then when you compare it to their Champions League form, another poor campaign where they're going to probably more than likely, they might not win another game in Asia. It's going to be over 10 years and about 6 or 7 campaigns without a win in Asia. For me, it's not looking good for them in terms of that. And it's if they don't I think for now, they've just got to focus on trying to close that gap, they're probably not going to finish second, but try and capitalize on that fixture and get to a grand final and somehow try and win it.
Well, that dovetails into our next question. Will the Victory's lack of quality at fullback be their downfall finals time?
Yep. Yes. There is. And the thing is as well, like we could say Thomas Deng and Lee Broxham fills in, but you pull Broxy out of midfield. Can Carl Valera, Raul Baena, and potentially KSK Honda, if Terry Antonis gets back as well, can they steer the ship in midfield defensively for a long period of game against those quick attackers? What do you think?
I think Tony Popovich team's choking the finals, and I think that might happen again.
But it's a different team. It's not the Wanderers now. Do you think that will carry over?
I think I don't know if it's something about Popovich or if it was a characteristic of his Wanderers teams. I'll be interested to find out. But I think Victory have just enough to be able to paper over these cracks in a one-off game. I can't guarantee they're going to win a championship, but if they make the grand final, you know that they can perform in big games. Lee Broxham at left back, Storm Roo at right back. Storm Roo's been serviceable. He's been okay.
At best.
Yeah. He's been okay. Centre back pairing of Deng and Donachy. I would keep Niedermeyer well away from the pitch if possible. Although, in the Perth Glory away game, he was one of the best players on the field. In midfield, Antonis not doing his knee has been an absolute blessing. So they still have him to call on. Baena, Valeri, Honda, Troisi. It's an embarrassment of riches, technically, in midfield. And then, obviously, you've got one of the most prolific strike partnerships in the league up front in Toivonen and Barbarousis. I think in a one-off game, regardless of their failings in the Asian Champions League, regardless of their failings in the league this season and the points they've dropped against teams that they shouldn't have lost to, let's not pretend that the Sydney loss is the reason that Victory have missed out on a home final. No. It's been the losses against teams like Newcastle and Geelong that have cost them these places.
Draws against Melbourne City, lost in round one as
well. Melbourne Victory are not a 5 o'clock on a Sunday kind of team. They're a prime time Saturday team, and they will get up for these big games.
I said it just before about them being a team that know how to win when it matters, and I think that that will carry over. But as I said, I'm just concerned if when they come up against your Sydneys and your Perth Glories, when they've got Economides, Castro, Ninkovic, De Jong, those guys running at those fullbacks, it's going to cause problems. Storm Roos, you said, serviceable, but can he step up in those big games when it matters in the finals and do that job on the right-hand side? It's not like when they used to have Daniel Georgievsky, even Stefan Nigroth and Thomas Deng last year in the finals were absolutely fantastic for stopgap fullbacks. And I think that the one thing Melbourne Victory should have done is, and one thing that I think they've failed to do for a very long time, is invest heavily in top quality fullbacks. The Perth Glory have got it so right with their fullbacks, and even, you guys say, with Sydney FC as well, with Grant, Zulo, Franjic, Davidson, because they're guys that are just top echelon. And even you could even say expansion team Western United already have better fullbacks than the Melbourne Victory. And they've got Josh Risden and Dylan Parise. That's just me speaking from the heart there. But I just honestly think that the Victory, that could really be it. But as you said, if the players around them step up, they could very well paper over the cracks in those big games. So, look, it's all there to be seen.
Let's keep going with the European stuff. Are Napoli finished in the Europa League?
You tried to wind me up this morning at 6:30 when I woke up and I saw the score. It was 2-0 and I thought, Jesus Christ, I'll better check Twitter and see how it's going. I see Josh Parrish is tagging me saying, oh, look at this, you know, second in Italy up against fifth in England. Hang on. No. Like, the one thing we've got to remember here is, have we looked at Arsenal throughout this Europa League and throughout their whole season about the difference between them at the Emirates v. them on the road? They were losing against Bate Borisov on the road, and they came back and won at home. Rennes, they lost on the road as well. I know they got a red card. I think Napoli are not finished by any matter of the imagination. I think that at the moment, their sole focus at the moment will be the Europa League. They're out of the Coppa Italia. They're going to finish second in Serie A. So that is a certainty that they don't really have to worry too much about it, because the other teams in Italy are not going to pressure them at this point, because Milan's falling over, Inter's falling over, Roma, Lazio have all got their own problems, Atalanta as well. They're going to be going all out in this game. And Napoli, even when they were in the Champions League, they were very good at home. But when they were on the road once again, it just seems like they were a completely different team. I honestly think they could beat Arsenal. I think that it will not be in normal time. I just have this feeling that Napoli are going to come out, they're going to beat them 2-0 in normal time and get them in extra time, because they've got, it's an embarrassment, we talk about embarrassment of riches up top. They have got one of the most dynamic front lines that Europe, that is possible in Europe. Insigne, Mertens.
Where was that this morning is what I want to know.
Well, that's the
where
thing
was
about,
that?
But it's been shown at home. It's even been their problem in Serie A. I've watched Napoli when they played against Milan and against in some of those other games as well, compared to when they're at home and on the road. On the road, just seems like they become this completely different team. But at home, they get the crowd, mind you, in Naples is absolutely mental. Like, we've seen just little bits.
They were basically the home crowd at the Emirates as well. They were the travelling fans.
But still, it's obviously, it's not like you're playing at the San Paolo. So I just think that there is no way you can write off Napoli. And yes, you say fifth in England versus second in Italy. Relax, would you? Just remember, Napoli were a kick away and some contentious decisions away from around a 16th spot in the Champions League. Against Liverpool in that game, they were very close. I just think that if they get going early against Arsenal and they get an early... If Arsenal score, it's over. They score the first goal, it's over. Napoli get on the score sheet early, they're going through. I'm telling you that now.
I don't know what you saw this morning. I guess you only watched it once I tagged
about,
you on Twitter.
I watched
Twitter.
About half an hour and I watched some of the highlights.
Nothing,
they weren't great.
Nothing you could have seen this morning would convince you that Napoli have any chance in the second leg. No away goal.
That's the thing about a two-legged tie, Josh. Things change,
rearrange all the time. I recognise that, but the tactics were all wrong from Ancelotti. He played a 4-4-2, and we all know that the 3-5-2 matches up very well against a 4-4-2 because you're outnumbering them
of
in
course.
Nearly every area.
And that's the problem with Ancelotti. That one thing that I will bet you do touch on very well is that his tactics, he always seems to always have only a plan A. But whether he has the nous, you know, Ancelotti's one of the greatest coaches to ever be over the past 20 years or so in Europe, whether he has, you know, even the players to actually change that and maybe sacrifice one of those attacking players and pull one extra into midfield, will he do it? He sold Matakamzic. He would have been that perfect player to put in that midfield three.
That's the thing.
Yeah, and
this isn't the old Napoli. This isn't the starting Napoli. Look at that midfield. Alan and Ruiz. Alan's a good player, but he's starting to get over the hill. Ruiz, I don't rate at all.
I think that they need to put Zielinski in that hard midfield. Zielinski's a freaking talent.
He is a talent, but he missed the best chance of the game. And you saw the captain from Napoli, Insigne, shrug his shoulders and then go high five the substitutes for his cross. And that's a bit of an indictment on where the team chemistry is in Napoli this point. But what about the performance of Aaron Ramsey this morning? He's given Napoli a nightmare prediction of what he's going to be like at Juventus next season. He absolutely dominated that game.
Well, if Ramsey actually starts.
He should have put the game, he will, and he should have put the game beyond doubt. We'll leave that for next week with one of the chances he missed. But Arsenal were flying, and if we're going to talk about coaches, talk about Unai Emery, who is the master of this competition, and he's just a better prepared tactical manager than Ancelotti is at this stage of his career. I saw, you know, Arsenal scoring goals, Napoli missing chances and making terrible defensive mistakes, and all Ancelotti's doing is putting a new piece of gum in his mouth on the sideline. He doesn't care anymore. He's collecting his superannuation money.
I've got actually an interesting point, though, if you want to hear an interesting stat. Arsenal have not won on the road since the start of February, and guess who that was against? Huddersfield. So yep. In between then, just in terms
they
of
they don't need to win,
stats,
though.
But looking at their last few games on the road, I'm just going to read some of these results that they've had. This just sums it all up. So since December, they've lost 3-2 against Southampton, 1-1 against Brighton, 5-1 against Liverpool. They beat Blackpool 3-0 in the FA Cup on the road, 1-0 loss against West Ham. They lost 3-1 against Man City, 2-1 against... they beat Huddersfield 2-1, lost 1-0 to Bartek Borisov, drew with Tottenham in the North London Derby, lost 3-1 to Rennes, and then lost against Everton on the weekend.
You know what? All of those results you read out are almost good enough to see them through against Napoli.
But still, is 5-1 not. But do they, any of those teams, barring maybe Tottenham and maybe Liverpool, have the same, those teams that they beat just, or those results are just, that have the same attacking quality than what Napoli has?
I really think Arsenal will go through. I don't think they'll win the second leg. I think Napoli will probably win, but Arsenal score an away goal and that will be that. We'll have to wait and see. But I am not confident in this Napoli side after seeing that disastrous display this morning with Koulibaly, supposed to be the greatest centre-back in the world. I don't know what he was doing for his position when he scored that goal.
Well, look, he had one of his very rare off games.
Yeah, and I would put him in my world 11, but he's just not in form, and none of these guys are.
Interesting about that. I think as well, he's playing alongside Maksimovic at the moment, and he's not his usual centre-back partner. It's usually Raul Albiol, which I think they haven't played much together, and maybe that's one of the things, but we can all speculate, but it's still all there to be played for. Let's see what happens next Friday. Let's continue going back to the Champions League just for a moment. And Juventus won all with Ajax. It was a very exciting game. Ajax very well could have won. It would have been an incredible win. But there was an interesting decision indecision that didn't go Juventus's way. There was a tug inside the box, which wasn't given, and Juventus could have very well had a penalty. How did you see that pan out?
I think that happens in Serie A like 40 times every week.
Are you trying to say that the Italian league are full of divers or something?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that they like a little bit of gamesmanship off set pieces, and they always have, and there's nothing wrong with that. But VAR, what it chooses to pick up on and what it chooses to let go is a complete mystery to me. As to whether that reaches the clear and obvious threshold, I'm not sure. It's a foul. Mm-hmm. But it's a foul in isolation. Yeah. He tugged him back, but as for the permutations of VAR and all that kind of stuff, who knows? It's not, you know, I don't think it's clear and obvious. I think it's up to the referee to decide. But the referee should have given a penalty.
Short and simple. Go back to Porto Roma's second leg and look at those two decisions that gave the penalty, and they're exactly the same. If that was given, then there's no reason why that one shouldn't have been given. That really should have been at least gone to VAR.
As soon as the guys go offside of you, you can't tug him back.
Exactly
you're
right.
Not, you shouldn't be able to. But players get away with it constantly. And that's why VAR is a massive can of worms. You've either got to punish every single one or let them all go.
Yeah.
Because if you punish every single one, then eventually, as we saw during the World Cup, things will change and suddenly set pieces become it changes the game profoundly once really set does. Pieces become that much of an advantage. Just ask the three lines.
Yes, we remember what happened at the World Cup when the big Harry Maguire's big noggin got up inside that box, and they really had that talent inside there, and that was almost the hallmark of their World Cup with those set pieces. But let's go back to Australia, Josh, and let's have a look at the Perth Glory. Now, myself and Athos Syriannos had this discussion on Wednesday, and it got a little bit heated. It was almost like an entree before the lightning round. There was a little bit of a how would you describe just that little bit of a teaser of what was to come? But I want to ask this question to you, and I was very adamant that they should. Perth, once they've wrapped up the Premier's plate, which could be as soon as this weekend, should they, if some players are sore, some players might be carrying a knock, considering they'll get that week off as well, should they rest at least a couple of those players and rotate, maybe give your Brimmers a run, your Brandon Wilsons, your Jacob Italianos, should they rotate their squad?
Perth Glory have an old squad. I think they do need to rest a couple of guys. It's the rest versus rust debate, and I'd be careful of not wanting to interrupt the flow that they're on, the run that they're on. But Tony Popovich has usually been happy to rotate two to three out of squads when he's had to. I think Diego Castro has to have a rest. One day probably needs a rest. Ivan Franić needs a rest. The other members of the team.
Neil Kilkenny maybe as well.
Maybe Kilkenny. He'll probably want to play, knowing Kilkenny.
Yeah,
well,
he's
pretty competitive.
Absolute warhorse.
Yeah, I think other than that, you should probably not tinker with it too much, because suddenly, you know, you lose a game, morale goes down, you're not on the same wavelength anymore.
Well, they've got the depth to do it as well. We must not forget.
They do.
They've got the players to rotate.
I don't think Jacob Italiano's seen virtually any minutes this season. Is he already in Germany? What's going on with him? So they've got players they could bring in. And if they've already wrapped up the silverware, I don't see why not. But I'd just be careful. If you're making wholesale changes and taking 11 players out and putting 11 in, I don't think that's the best way to prepare for a final series.
Little side note, Tony Popovich is known for mass rotations. Mm. And we've known he likes to rotate the squads. Very rare when you almost see him play the same 11 more than 2 weeks in a row. I think that as well with Chris Economides going down for this period of time, I would not be playing Economides before finals. Considering if he has dislocated his shoulder, you do not want to rush him back and you want him at peak fitness for the first week of finals. I know there's that whole discussion of, you know, you don't want them to miss potentially two weeks of football and then come back for that semi-final and be potentially gassed out by the time they get to that game if they miss the last game or two of the season. But if they're sore, as you said, the likes of Diego Castro,
if they're injured, they shouldn't play.
Yeah, if they're even 80%, you wouldn't play them.
If they need painkillers to get through the game, then they shouldn't play in a fixture that doesn't matter.
Exactly right. Let's move on to that one. And former Melbourne Victory captain, would you say? Yep. Cal Valeri has announced his retirement. And, well, he's a premiership captain. And where does he go down in Victory folklore? Almost in Australian football folklore to a degree. Because he's almost been, like, you go through the resume. I know there's a lot of people being very critical about Cal Valeri, and his role has not been the most flashy. Like, he's not your, he very rarely will get on the score sheet. He won't put your pass that will cut open a defence. But he's played over 50 games for the Socceroos and featured at World Cups and been a big part of the Melbourne Victory and played in Italy's lower leagues. Is this, you know, do you think that this has still been, is he still ranked quite high in the Melbourne Victory history?
I think he does. He came back to Australia when he was still almost at his peak, just over, and helped win two championships. That first championship team in 2015 with Mark Milligan, the two of them running box to box when Valeri still had that in his locker, they absolutely dominated, won the double. That's an all-time great team. The Victory team of last season, not so classic a vintage, but Carl Valeri, all the same, was very important. I think his playing style is something of a remnant of an era gone by, the sort of mid to late 2000s era, dual holding midfield players in a 4-2-3-1 that were sitting in front of the defence and not doing too much of the attacking. It was a really quite negative era.
Sergio Busquets-esque sort of player, a bit more
less
defensive.
Busquets, more, you know, De Jong.
Mark Noble.
Yeah, see, like more, yeah, more of those players who really sat.
Nigel De Jong, probably the best example.
Mascherano, those kinds of guys. Think of, you know, Jose Mourinho's Inter in 2010 kind of type sides.
Esteban Cambiaso-esque, yeah.
I think...
Well, Cambiaso's a bit more dynamic. Yeah. He was crazy, but, you know.
Those water carriers. And Cavalieri obviously is never going to, you know, no one's going to buy a ticket to see Cavalieri play. He's not going to be the guy on the poster that gets you to the game. But he's been a fantastic leader for Melbourne Victory, and he's helped them win silverware. And I think he's been on a real kindred spirit with Kevin Muscat. He's Muscat's presence on the field. And look at his career in Serie B as well with Grosseto and Sassuolo. He's done very well for himself. And he's got over 50 Socceroos caps, which I had no idea.
I think that people forget about that in between 2007 and 2014, he played 52 games, scored an Asian Cup semi-final as well against Uzbekistan back in 2011, and started against Germany in that 4-0 defeat. I don't know if you want to put that down in your resume, but... And again, starting in a World Cup game, quite impressive. Also was at the 2007 Asian Cup and was at the 2004 Summer Olympics as well. Also, a little side note about Cavalieri, which I think is quite remarkable. Remember, he spent almost all of the 2015-16 campaign on the sidelines with an illness and was able to return from that, which not a lot of players...
swelling of the brain. Was
exactly. So to come crazy. Back and then play in that for the remainder of that season, and then to play... 2 to 3 seasons, this is now his third season of full-blown football, barely missing a game, it is remarkable. And considering for a player at his age now, at 34, many thought he wouldn't even be playing for the Victory this season. Many thought that last year would have been it and he would have maybe moved on or gone and played in the NPL or another A-League club. But I think that this is a good way for him to sign off. As you said, not flashy, but what he did, it's quite impressive. Like he... did start his career at Inter. People forget about that. He was actually on Inter's books and he was loaned out to, as we said, Grosseto, Spal, Sassuolo, was actually sold by Sassuolo when they basically got promoted. So that goes to show that, yeah, look, you know what? Like he was part of it, but then at the end of the day, he was sort of moved on. He was past it a little bit and he's come to the Melbourne Victory and he's done a fantastic job. So kudos to Cavalieri. To their neighbours, Melbourne City. Now, they have had probably the season where here at FNR, especially in evenings, they have dominated the headlines for maybe not the right reasons. There's been constant, I know for me in particular, I've spoken a lot about Warren Joyce and Bruno Fornaroli and their struggles, but they've found themselves in a weird position, in my opinion. Like, they're going to play finals, but it's not convincing. And they could very well have a home final come a couple of weeks' time. Is it a pass mark? And does that really even change anything? Warren Joyce?
Changes absolutely nothing because their pass mark was third place and Asian Champions League qualification. And that was their pass mark last season. They got there and then it was cruelly ripped from their grasp in the most deliciously satisfying of circumstances. Warren Joyce is gone. He's not going to be sticking around at the club. I think he'll either go to Wellington Phoenix, which is a bizarre rumour. Oh, I think it would be a huge mistake. No. But their rumours are there. I've heard from multiple sources. And there's also obviously that offer that he doesn't want to talk about back in Manchester. I don't think he's sticking around. I think he's done. I think the next coach of Melbourne City, I don't think will be any more progressive in his footballing choices because I think it's going to be Patrick Cisnorbo.
Yeah, a coach that who we've heard a lot is very similar in his tactics. And
think of the way Patrick Cisnorbo played football. He's exactly the same. He's exactly the same on the sideline. And I'm not a huge fan of the style. I don't think that's going to bring City fans back through the gates if they have the dormant fan base, which I'm not sure that they do.
I think the only thing Melbourne City can take out of this season as a positive has been Richie Delatt, Bart Schenkerval to a degree, Jamie McLaren second half of the season, and Shaun Harrison's little run now. Other than that, it has just been a disaster. Like, they haven't necessarily given the young kids that they have bragged
they're
about.
They're all leaving.
Pariah is off. I believe Nazarene and Najjar, like they're really on the outer. There's a whole range of other players.
I think Josh Cavallo is rumoured to be gone.
Yep. James Dalianov, still, we haven't seen him. We saw them sign Mark Birogidi. He didn't even feature. He hasn't featured at all. He'll probably be on his way out. They keep going to these guys that have just been there for, like, just A-League typical stalwarts, like your Jacopo La Roccas that still find a way to start, and Harrison Delbridge. And not to take anything away from them, but there are guys there that are ready to go and ready to play, and there are guys who are actually naturally better than them now and are looking to take that next step in their career. They're playing right backs in striker. They're trying all sorts of things, and then you saw the whole thing that dragged on for so long with Bruno Fornaroli. I don't see, as I said, I don't see Warren Joyce being at Melbourne City next season. I could see him going back to Manchester.
If he sticks around next season, it's an
Wellington pick him up, you talk about indictment, that if he's there, it's a disaster if they go from Mark Rudin to Warren Joyce in terms of exciting, attacking, beautiful football.
I mean, Mark Rudin is a counter-attacking manager, but at least it's good to watch.
Yeah, and they score goals, and they've got, and I'll tell you what, he's done such a great job with what he has. And I just don't think Warren Joyce going to Wellington fits the players that they have either, because they've got, such as you said, such a great counter-attacking team that when you've got Krishna Williams, Singh, and those guys playing off the shoulder, it's almost impossible to beat, especially defensively with that pace. Talking about Wellington, they were defeated 3-0, 3-1?
3-1.
3-1 on the road. Sorry, I got one mixed up. They were down 3-0 at halftime against Adelaide, and it was a real shock to the system because I didn't see that scoreline coming. Should we read into it at all, or was that just the due loss that teams sort of sometimes need to just reinvigorate them a little bit before finals?
I'm really not sure which way to come down on this one because I do think Wellington are a better team than Adelaide. I just do, even though they're not really separated on by the table, and Adelaide have just done them with 10 men, no less. Apostolos Stamatolopoulos getting a run in the first team and then immediately getting sent off after scoring one of those two goals.
You know those memes where they say, like, girl, come over. I'm sorry, I'm playing football. No, I have a free house.
I was going to use the explained quickly meme, but you went there. That's all right. And Mark Rudin obviously furious with his striker. I don't think he had anything to complain about with the decision because it was a potential leg breaker on Mandy. Mm. And that's a weird matchup because there was some bad feeling between those teams earlier in the season when it was Mandy who was the one who was red carded. I don't think there's much to read into it at all. Sometimes you get a bad result. I think Wellington will bounce back from this stronger.
I think so as well. And they're in a fantastic position. It has been a major pass, A-plus season for them. Brisbane Roar this weekend, I think that they'll just breeze past them tonight. They really could win that game very convincingly. We talked about how they beat the Mariners 8-2. It's going to be very much in the same vein. It could be another 3 or 4 goal win. Then Melbourne City and Perth Glory to wrap up the season, which I think they'll at least get one win from those. Considering Perth, they'll probably have the Premier's plate wrapped up. They're at home. And Wellington more than likely be playing for a home final. And Perth for basically nothing except just getting the players through to the first week of the finals. So I think that for me, Wellington, they're in a pretty good position. Let's not read too much into it. I'm calling it as a due loss that they needed.
Also, I think Mark Rudin's gone at the end of the season, so hopefully they get some success while they still can. We were speaking about Adelaide. Can they cause any realistic damage in the finals? And by extension, I guess.
Well, yeah, if you're there.
Should they? And by extension, is sacking Marco Kurz the right decision?
I think they went a bit too early, especially if he does well in the finals. I think if they get a home final, if it's against Wellington or if it's against Melbourne City, they're going to win. So I think they're going to find themselves in the semi-final. I just can't see Adelaide losing at home against either of those sides. I think if Wellington away, I think he's a very different team to Wellington at the Cake Tin. So I just think that Adelaide in particular, if they get all the cards and the right players out in the field they need, I think that they've got everything barring the number 9. Now, Apostolos showed a bit, but he's got that bit of a temper, and I'm a bit worried about it a little bit, Apo. So if he's out in the field and he's playing well, that's the thing that we haven't really ruled out, is that he's going to be gone at the end of the season too. So that's another player to rule out effectively. So, look, you've still got guys like Craig Goodwin, Ryan Kiddo, Milosevic is now injured. But you've got Isaias. You've got those quality players. Ben Halloran as well can offer a bit. They're a weird team, Adelaide, aren't they? They're probably the biggest enigma in this competition because sometimes they can come out and put in this A-class performance where they get a win against a great opposition, and sometimes they can completely be just the complete opposite.
Injuries have been tough for them this season. Also, selling Taylor Reagan, who paid his own transfer fee to get out of there, which tells you a little bit, and not buying a replacement centre-back. They had to field Morone and Isaias as the centre-back combination. Having said that, I think Kurz's style of football, it reaches a ceiling when it comes to finals time.
Yeah.
He can get results against sides during the regular season, but he just doesn't have the creativity, especially if they concede the first goal. And would have changed the game against Melbourne Victory in the finals last time if Baba Diawara put away that one-on-one chance.
Oh, yeah.
but his football is limited. It's reliant on crossing. They haven't had a centre forward to nod those crosses in. And even then, crossing against a set defence is just not a particularly threatening attack. It's predictable. It's predictable. And that's the one thing that I associate with Marco Kurz's football is predictability. I think it was the right barring a terrible coaching appointment in his stead, I think it was the right decision to get rid of him by the new consortium, because I think they have different footballing ideas. And in my opinion, that's an entirely valid reason for getting rid of a coach if you don't believe in his style of play.
You do talk about crossing in, and you're going to cross into Apostolos Stamatolopoulos or Ben Halloran or Craig Goodwin, whoever it is leading the line, and stop Babadiawara or someone who has a bit of height on them. It's going to be an absolute
George
disaster.
Blackwood has some height as well, and but
Jordy,
he's not
Jordy
exactly
Thomason
the...
has been not necessarily...
Jordy Thomason has been one of the worst signings of the season. It's underrated because no one even knows who he is.
He's been so bad
that no one actually knows that he's signed for.
And to be honest, like, if you look at his resume prior to that, his goal-scoring record was not necessarily...
It's not too flashy. Well. You never know once they get to Australia, but he's been exactly as bad as Wikipedia looked.
It hasn't been like Bess Aparicio, who came here and became, like, over in Europe, he was not scoring goals, but down here became an absolute god. Let's go back to Europe, and let's look at one of the sides that have been relegated from the EPL, and that's Fulham. They came into this season, and I thought that they were going to be something special with the players they had. Some very great, fantastic young talents, Seri, Sessegnon. They had Alexander Mitrovic, who probably has been one of the only bright lights this season. Have they been the biggest disappointment in the EPL this season?
I think they have been. They're just based on the amount of money that they spent. I had high hopes for them. I liked a lot of the signings. I liked them signing Schürrle. The central midfield player, help me out here.
Seri
is just a fantastic footballer. I just think they maybe tried to change the squad too much and it didn't gel. And defensively, they've been very suspect. So they've been through three managers now, is it?
Yeah, Ranieri
came in,
sacked.
came out. It's been a disaster for them. And given the level of investment, I don't think there's any other contenders for this position.
And to be honest, they really shouldn't be where they are. Like, them and Huddersfield are on their way to potentially two of the worst records ever in Premier League history. And when I saw Fulham, I thought this season that they would have stayed up and looked to have consolidated their spot in at least the bottom half of the table. I honestly thought that they weren't in my bottom three. There was no way. I honestly thought it was going to be Huddersfield, Cardiff and Southampton that were going to go down this season. I did not think that it would be Fulham. And when you've got those players, I know Mitrovic has been fantastic, but it just seems like he hasn't had the supporting cast to have stepped up to that level. And it's, for me, it's a big F. It just has not been their season, and it's going to be back down to the Championship. Sorry, I think about Serie A.
To be honest, this team could be a Pozzo team, looking at the makeup of it.
It could be
in Serie B.
Yeah, well, they're probably going to go back to the Championship, probably playing, well, I don't know if they'll be playing my boys Wigan next season. They've got their own problems, but... Look, it's disappointing considering that they'd been down for a while. They had their own problems. And look, you remember when you were younger, Fulham were a Premier League staple. Like Craven Cottage games night were always a fantastic thing. They'd, you know, your Mark Schwartz's, your Clint Dempsey's, their Europa League run where they made the final.
Didn't they beat Juventus one
time? Yeah, they did. They made it all the way to the final and lost. Big Bobby Zamora leading the line as well. And they were a team that historically they're known as being one of those Premier League staples, as I said. But for me, it's just been... big F for them, and they're going to be one of those teams, like we've seen almost all three of the sides that got relegated from the Prem last year have all struggled except for West Brom in the Championship this season. So I'm a bit fearful that if they aren't careful, because I think they're going to lose a lot of players. Like, there's no way Mitrovic will be playing Championship. Sessegnon and Seri have got big price tags because they've got the age behind them and clubs will be willing to invest. So let's see what happens. But looking further up the table, Liverpool take on Chelsea this weekend, and it's a game with a lot on the line for two different reasons. Liverpool, in particular, looking to just keep that little gap on Man City. Obviously, Man City with that game in hand, and Chelsea looking to consolidate their spot in the top four. Who has more to lose in this game?
It's Liverpool. It's obviously the title team. It's obviously the title team. Chelsea, I mean, they've got a little mini league for the rest of the Champions League qualification, which financially speaking is a huge thing, but given that they can't sign anybody, how big a deal is it really?
They're going to take my boy Bakayoko back, and that's going to be an absolute disaster.
They're going to get a transfer ban, and then, you know, they're not going to be able to sign anybody. They're going to get loads of money for the Hazard deal. Champions League qualification isn't that significant for them, aside from maybe losing a few players that might want to go. I think Hazard's already going, which is why I'm saying Liverpool, 2 points ahead in the Premier League with Man City having a game in hand. This is squeaky bum time for the Liverpool fans. They are getting nervous. They are really getting nervous. It's hot in here, and I think they're going to have another meltdown, if I'm honest.
Isn't it that's just that old familiar position? I know that it was a few games later back in 2014 and Liverpool took on Chelsea at Anfield, and we'll never forget what happened when Steven Gerrard picked the ball up at halfway and went for a bit of a tumble and Demba Ba went in and scored. I just have this feeling, and I don't like saying it. Liverpool, I just have this feeling Chelsea's going to win this weekend. I have this feeling, and
Hazard,
I think it's going to be
always amazing at Stamford Bridge. He's always amazing.
It's at Anfield.
At Anfield, I should say. I meant to say Anfield. He's always great when he plays.
And how good has Hazard been the past few games? Like even this morning as well against Slavia Prague.
When he wants to turn it on, he's sensational, as we know. And I think he will want to turn it on under the bright lights of this game. He hasn't really been bothered in a lot of games this season, but remember the start he had the first six weeks, he's looked like the best player in the world. The thing that would give me pause is that Liverpool have a little bit more creativity in the way they go forward.
Two extra days off as well, we must remember, because Chelsea did play this morning. Liverpool played back on Wednesday. So they have those two extra days to get some bodies right. Chelsea, don't know. I'll have a look at their squad who played this morning, but I don't know how much rotation will go into the team that played against Slavia Prague on the road.
They've got fullbacks who can score goals and set up goals. They've got Bobby Firmino, who's the most important player in that Liverpool lineup, in my opinion, because of his movement. He can unlock defences.
Draw centre-backs out as well.
I don't think Sarri is going to play the same way that Mourinho did, spoiler, as in that fateful game that we mentioned. Yeah. I don't think he has it in his DNA. So I think Liverpool will win this game, but it's Liverpool. They're not going to do it. They're not going to make it easy for themselves. They're not going to win 3-0. It's going to be a last-minute last gasp goal.
Divock Origi goal again.
Chelsea missing a penalty or something.
Kepa gets injured, doesn't want to come off, and then there's some sort of drama, and then Liverpool score.
You can see it already. It's going to be a meltdown one way or the other.
Just a little side question. This is just something that we haven't even written down the script. I was just having a look at Chelsea's team. Where to next for Gonzalo Higuain? Like, he has
Weight Watchers.
Like, he got offloaded by Milan. He has been, I'd say, a big failure at Chelsea, and Juventus don't want him next season. Is it done for him in Europe?
In Europe? Oh, well, I guess if a big Qatari team comes in with an investment, he could go play with Benatia, maybe.
The farewell, and Rick Dandré has now just pulled up a chair behind the glass, and he's listening because he loves to talk about Gonzalo. But I think he'll be off to maybe the UAE or the Arab Gulf, or maybe off to China, the MLS. His brother, I think, still might play in the MLS. He might be tempted to go and play over there for the big money. Well, we do have a Foxtel fund down here. Yeah, you never know. But look, I think in terms of his European career, it's over.
I don't think it's necessarily over. I think, you know, Premier League, you know, maybe a bit tough for him. I think Serie A is more his level.
But I don't think there'll be any other Serie A team other than Milan or Juventus, maybe Inter, that'd be willing to dip into the...
You don't have to run as much in Serie A. You can just stay in the box.
In all fairness, interesting thing about Higuain, even when he was at Milan, his movements, even when he was in the box, he was getting the service. He just couldn't finish. So it goes to show that there's something going on with him, and it's not just down to that service. It's down to just himself. Like ever since the World Cup, he's just been on this slope, downhill just trajectory, and it's not looked good for him. And
just depression, eating his feelings.
Always put on a couple kilos every year. And I think the only team in Serie A that would realistically take him might be Inter if Icardi decides to leave. But how would you want to look in your resume that you've played for Napoli? You made that controversial move to Juventus. You went to Milan, and now you're going to go to Inter. You're upsetting almost every fan base around, and you're going to look like a snake. And there are already Napoli fans that still think he's a bit of a snake. So big question marks for Pipita.
I think he's done, but I also think that another European team will offer him a contract, even if it's, you know, Turkey or somewhere.
Yeah.
I think there will be a Serie A team who says, all right, let's come here, Gonzalo. It all depends on his wage demands.
And they're not going to be low.
If he's willing to compromise us a little bit, he'll be back in Serie A before you know it. Whether he'll be successful or not, that's
a completely
different story.
Could he go back to La Liga next season, maybe? Like, Real Madrid do need a striker, and he has a bit of history there. They might, obviously, I don't know. I don't rate Karim Benzema in the same way I used to.
Benzema's been really good this season, though. He's been good. They've had a bad season, but he scored goals. Karim Benzema is a very underrated player, but we'll have to leave that
for
this week. We've got too many topics to
move on
through. Who is in a worse off position, Nick? Brisbane or the Central Coast Mariners?
Brisbane Roar. Brisbane Roar. Off the field. They're both stuffed off the field. But at least, like, with the Central Coast, like, I know that Alan Stajic is coming in and they've got at least some... We know it's Stajic will more than likely be there next season. I just think that Central Coast, they're in a better position all round. I think that as well, like, I don't know what it is about Brisbane, but it just seems like every time I watch them, there's this gloom. It just looks like a depressed period at the moment. With the Mariners, I don't know why. I don't know if it's just me, but I just feel like every time they play, it's like at least they're giving it a crack. Like, they're just not that great. But, you know, I just think that next season, Central Coast could actually... They got a lot to play for next season. That actually leads in very well to our next question.
I think
Roar, in terms of what's happening off the field as well with their ownership stuff as well and not having a coach, and they might be bringing in Robbie Fowler, who has no coaching pedigree. It could get even worse for them next season. And they don't necessarily have the players they've got as well. Like, a lot of those older bodies are going to move on. Eric Boltiak on the way out. Brett Holman hasn't even featured. He's on the way out. Christensen. They just have Dylan Wenzel-Hall's FC. And that's really the only thing that... No, in all fairness, Dylan Wenzel-Hall's...
I like the sound of that. Can that be an expansion team?
DWHFC. I don't mind that. But Dylan Wenzel-Hall's around him, tell me, like, is there anyone else that breeds... Like, Joe Coletti's barely been given a crack this year. I don't even know what's going to happen with him next season. They've had young Powell who's come in, who's tried hard. Connor O'Toole, the poor guy did his knee. Jamie Young can only do so much between the sticks. They haven't got much else that's going right for them.
I tell you what they have got. They have got one of the best youth academies in the country. They have a free
youth
system. But
will they play them?
I don't know. It depends on the coach. It depends on the coach. But they do have all those young players before they get poached by Melbourne Victory, which they usually do. They do have the National Youth League winning squad. And that's something to lean on. Also, they've got a huge dormant fan base from the Ange Postecoglou era. Brisbane is a big sporting town. They don't have the ceiling that Gosford has. Brisbane Roar is, regardless of the ownership situation, regardless of the playing squad, they are always going to be in a much better position than the Central Coast Mariners, purely because of the fan base. And leading into our next question, the Brisbane Roar aren't in danger of getting relegated anytime soon. I think it's pretty easy.
Is that actually a thing?
All right, Dave Davutovich, in his Studs Up article the other day, pointed out a clause in the club participation agreement that says if a club finishes as the Wooden Spoon team 3 seasons in a row, they can be relegated from the league. Relegated in inverted commas. It means their license will be taken away and given to another team. It can happen.
So we're going to go to 11 teams and we're going to go back to 10 maybe. Well, then Southwest Sydney coming, but we'll be back to 11, another odd number.
No,
again.
But they'd probably give it to another side. Move the license.
South Melbourne.
It's time.
But no, I actually think that if they do fit, you know what? I would put the fire under them and say, literally, it should just be you finish last next season. You know, they always say there's no incentive for the Mariners to not finish last because they can be there next season. Just say to them, if you don't finish last, you're going down. Like, too bad. I know it sounds so harsh.
I mean, that's not the most aspirational goal we've ever heard, but I suppose it's something.
But it's the same thing that all Premier League clubs face and all clubs around the world face that are struggling. It's like if you finish in the bottom three, sorry, you can have a great season and have a bit of luck not go your way. You can win the FA Cup like Wigan did, but if you finish in the bottom three, sorry, but you're going down division. And if you're Central Coast, you're consistently underperforming, then, yeah, well, you're an NPL club. There are NPL teams that are better than the Mariners right now. You could probably name at least 4 or 5. Apia, Avondale, Heidelberg, Sydney Olympic. There you go.
Bentley Greens,
5.
Yeah, they're probably... Avondale even. You said Avondale, sorry.
They're at least 5 that are better than them, and there are probably a whole range that could at least be competitive.
Yeah. Central Coast are in a mess. I think they're a town ill-suited to propping up a league that's flailing. If the A-League was in rude health, I'd say, yeah, look, it's great to have whatever, Blue Tongue Stadium, what's it called? It's just called Central Coast Stadium, right? They don't have a sponsor for the stadium. Can't even call it Master Foods.
And they named it after basically the tongue of a lizard.
I will sorely miss them if they go. I will sorely miss them.
The sauce bottles. Usain Bolt.
They're a classic. There's actually rare birds nesting at one end of the ground, so they can't use some of the seeding areas because it's like an endangered species.
They're a meme.
This could only happen on the Central Coast, and we will lose all of that. Matt Simon, the Wizard of War, but just commercial reality dictates that this place is just not big enough to support a team, and it's not big enough to support a football team in particular. When the local council, when it hasn't even got another major sporting franchise, does everything it possibly can to push football out of the town and bring rugby in. So if it's not going to be receptive, then you've got a difficult situation. I think you might have to say, Central Coast, go play in the Northern New South Wales Premier League.
It's like having a team in Gosford, like I was still only 7 years old when the A-League started, and I never knew where Central Coast were from. And when I was in Gosford, I never even knew where Gosford was. No offence, but like if you're starting a competition, like for me, it's I still question it. Like what did Gosford have to offer? Was it because it was just a new town and maybe at that time I'd been some sort of boom that there was some that had a rectangular stadium and maybe they had something to offer. And obviously at the start, Central Coast were in a position where they were one of the best A-League teams and still, historically speaking, they're still one of the top five best. They've made grand finals. They've won premierships before. But look, let's now move on because we've got 6 minutes to go in the first ever edition of the Lightning Round.
I think we're on time as well. We actually are. Two topics.
We've got two left. And let's go back to Europe. Let's finish off over in Spain. Villarreal are in another one of those weird positions. We talk about relegation. They're third last in the Liga, but they're still in the Europa League. I wrote this question out last night, and I thought that maybe they had a chance of winning this morning, but they lost 3-1. But still, the possibility of a semi-final is still there. But let's maybe rephrase it. Could they be one of the first teams in the final eight of the Europa League, or in that situation, maybe the final four, and be relegated to Segunda in the same season?
I think Villarreal, judged based on the caliber of players they've had in the past and not on the actual size of the team they really are. It is a sleepy little town, Villarreal.
Yeah.
It's tiny. They had Riquelme. They've got Santi Cazorla. I love seeing him play. He's just one of my favourites just as a human being as well as a footballer, and it's great to see him back to full fitness. I think they'll eventually come out in the wash. I think
they got relegated a few years ago.
They
as well.
Did.
Yeah.
They did. I think they're run on a fairly tight budget, and they could probably come back up. You're not going to get into a situation, like some of the teams in Spain that are sleeping giants in the second division in the Segunda. I think they're better than Valladolid. I'll go out on a limb and say they're better than Valladolid. They're on the same points. They've got a much better goal difference. And, you got to look ahead and examine their fixtures in the last few weeks of the season. I think they can get just enough points to scrape by. Look, they've got Girona, Leganés, Real Sociedad, Huesca, Madrid, who they beat this season, Eibar, and Getafe. I think that's a run of fixtures that you can get at least 9-10 points from, and that should be enough to stay up.
And this morning, they did concede those two late goals in the 90 and 93rd minutes to Daniel Vaz and Gonçalo Guedes, which did eliminate them.
That's over. That tie's over. I thought even a draw would not be enough, because if you have to go to Mestalla, which is one of the most intimidating atmospheres in world football, those fans, I mean, if their team's winning, they will.
Well, Valencia just seem to draw every week at the moment. Mm. They are the perennial.
I mean, they're pretty
team.
Demanding fans. They will turn on you in a heartbeat, but they're pretty ferocious as well. So I don't think there's any hope of VRL overturning that and winning 3-0 at Mestalla. That's done.
And it's incredible because last season, like I'm looking at some of the players they have gotten rid of and brought in. They sold Samuel Castillo to Milan for $25 million, Rodri to Atletico Madrid for another $20 million. Mm. And they had as well guys
They've
like.
Had some tidy players, haven't they?
Yeah, well, they technically.
Baye played there,
Eric
I think.
Baye was there not long ago. Denis Cheryshev got loaned out after his fantastic World Cup. And they brought in guys like Santi Cazorla, Miguel Layún, Carlos Bacca, Santiago Cáceres. But they haven't really. They brought in as well Ramiro Funes Mori from Everton as well for $20 million. He's sitting on the bench.
Well,
they've still
an
got
unreliable centre back if ever I saw one.
If there's any AC Milan fans out there listening, if you want to talk about throwback, they've still got Daniele Bonera in their squad at 37 years old.
I didn't know he was still playing.
Well, I had no idea as well, but he's still hanging around. Very interesting. Final question of the day. Borussia Dortmund have all but now, in my opinion, squandered the Bundesliga after being obliterated by Bayern 5-0 last week. That's it, surely.
Look at the table, though. It's 1 point.
Yeah, but will Bayern drop that point?
It's 1 point. It's a competitive league. I think they can do it. Well, all right, let's have a look at Bayern's fixtures then. Because
I'll get Dortmund's up, you get Bayern's.
All right. Bayern are playing Fortuna Düsseldorf. Probably not going to drop those points. But Werder Bremen, Nuremberg, Hanover, Leipzig away is the tough game. Eintracht could do some damage. So I think that Leipzig game is the one. If they drop
Eintracht
that Leipzig
well,
game, then I think Dortmund can still win this title. I don't think this Bayern team's as good as people give them credit for. I just really think they're overrated as a club, to be honest.
We saw that especially in the Liverpool tie in particular. They really looked an absolute shadow of their former selves. Dortmund, they have Mainz this weekend at home, Freiburg away, Schalke at home, and Schalke this year probably one of the weirder teams in all of
European
football.
That's a tough game because of the derby.
It's a derby, but Schalke have been, just in the Bundesliga, absolutely deplorable. Very different to what they have been in the Champions League, and they are actually only 5 points clear of the relegation playoff. They take on Werder Bremen away, Fortuna Dusseldorf at home, but listen to this final game. Borussia Mönchengladbach on the road. And doesn't matter about, you know, obviously Mönchengladbach being fifth, but that is a very tough game on the road and that could really go either way. So, look, the more I think about it, this could very well go to the final day, but I just think Bayern's going to somehow squeak over the line just because Dortmund have just not been able to capitalise on those opportunities. Their last five games, Dortmund dropped points in one of them as well, and Bayern have just seemed to get wins on the board, and they showed that 5-0 win. To lose like that, it can really damage your confidence as well. That's something we must not rule out. And in particular, four of those goals all came before halftime. So it's,
I might be thinking with my heart and not my head here,
and
to be 20, honest.
And 22 shots to four in that game as well. It was just a complete smash.
I just think this Bayern team is pretty stolid, and Dortmund are just so much more exciting to watch. I still think they've got a hope. They're not the favourites, obviously, but I still think they can do it.
Well, Josh, we've got to go now, and unfortunately, though, our second episode is going to have to wait 2 weeks because next weekend is Good Friday and there'll be no programming on Good Friday. So that episode's going to be, it's going to be must, well, not miss. How are Rose? It's getting late. It's going
must
to be
listen.
Must listen radio, to say the least, or must watch on Facebook Live because we're going to have all the fallout from Champions League, Europa League. I believe by that stage, it'll be the last week of the A-League season. A lot can happen in 2 weeks of football, let alone a lot can happen in a day. So let's wait and see what's going to happen in those 2 week period.
Thank you very much for all of you out there in FNR land for tuning in. This is Josh Parrish, Nick DiBarno signing off. See you in 2 weeks.
And remember, there's always got to be a way.